once again to Prayer Quest. I'm Father Thomas DuBay, Society of Mary, Marist Father. You may recall that last time we just got a bit of an introduction to this whole question of solving time pressures and getting a prayer life that is really suitable for anyone following Christ completely. And I had made the point that we all bring assumptions to a question like this, and both sides of a disagreement will often be sure. Each side is sure it's right and the other's wrong, and often the disagreement is about basics on which they build their conclusions. And I want to be open with you today and tell you frankly what my presuppositions, my assumptions are as we talk about this problem, and I will get more specific as we go on. When I say my presuppositions, I don't mean they are personal property. I do mean that any consistent theist would have to hold these presuppositions. So if later on you should disagree about what I will call pointers towards solution of the problem, I don't ask you to accept the thing because I say it, who am I? But I would ask you to examine your assumptions. They're not the ones I'm going to mention now. The first premise on which I'm going to base practicalities is that a person is an end of absolute value. We said this a few weeks ago, that as a person you may never be viewed by anyone as a cog in a machine, even a good machine. You're a person first. And that has lots of implications if one takes it seriously. You do not deal with persons as things, expendable things, and they're not robots. The second presupposition is that work in human life is provisional. It is not, number one, it is not the eternal thing. The Lord made that point with Martha in that Martha-Mary account, saying to her, Martha, you're disturbed about many things, but one is needful, namely what Mary's doing, contemplating the Word made flesh. And he said, it will not be taken from her. She's doing the eternal thing, beginning it now in dark faith, completing it in beatific vision. The human person is made to celebrate, to rejoice, to be overflowing with love forever. And work, therefore, is only temporary and provisional. Thirdly, we are going to take the premise and operate on it from Vatican II that in the Church, quote, action is subordinated to contemplation. And that, therefore, a second thing, action, work, may not habitually squeeze out a first thing. There can be exceptions, and when I say habitually, I mean that it can happen. There's an emergency in the house, in the home, in the convent, wherever it happens to be. We've got to take care of the emergency. Maybe that day we can't get much prayer in. But regularly, second things may not squeeze out first things. That's the premise that action work is subordinated to contemplation. Begin, again, to recall, because we're persons. It's because of who we are and our destiny. The fourth presupposition, I'm going to borrow also from Vatican Council II, and it's a statement about religious. Brothers and sisters and priests in a diocese, what do religious do there? And in the decree on the pastoral office of bishops, there's a section on religious and dioceses. And I want to read you a little bit of this. It is their duty to foster these objectives, building up the church, primarily, notice that adverb, primarily by means of prayer, works of penance, and the example of their own life, period. If you have religious running a hospital, their main duty in that diocese is not running the hospital. If you have other ones teaching in school, their main duty is not teaching in school, it's prayer, penance, and example. Now, if we had lots of time, I could give you cogent reasons why that is so. I'm just taking this as a premise. And what is said here of religious is basically true of anyone, that we are on the face of the earth for the greatest commandment, love God, whole heart, soul, and mind, and then the second, we love our neighbor as ourselves, and we serve the neighbor. But it has to be in that order to get things right. And that brings us to the last premise that will undergird my comments in a practical vein, namely that we are to imitate the whole Christ, everything about him, not only his mercy and his gentleness, we're to imitate him also at prayer. And we remember what we've said in other of these sessions, let me just give you one text that summarizes them all on this point. Namely, Luke 5:16, Jesus, says Luke, would always go off to some place where he could be alone and pray. The Greek word is habitually. He would habitually go off despite all the work he did, and he's needed, by the way, immeasurably more by other people than you and I are needed by other people. And so if he can spend this habitual long periods of time at prayer, certainly we can. It would be blasphemous to think that people need me more than they need him. And we're taking him seriously. He is our model here in all vocations of life. Now that brings us to detail and briefly the three problems that make up the time pressure problem, at least for most people. The first one is so clear I need merely mention it. Namely, sheer lack of time. People will say, I cannot live the kind of prayer life you've been promoting. I don't have the time for it. I don't have the hours in the day. Sheer lack of time problem. I'm not saying I agree with that, but at the moment, we can be content. Many people would present that as an obstacle they can't overcome. The second aspect of the time pressure problem, we may call the mind pressure problem. And the best way I can explain this one is from a question I received in a question box. It was from a sister. I had spoken about deep prayer life in the retreat, and we had questions and question periods. And here is what she wrote on her question. Father, now during retreat, and you know that sisters make retreats of 5, 6, 8 days, not just a weekend retreat. Now during retreat, prayer comes easily. But during the school year, we are so rushed, one activity after another, that we cannot pray well or advance in any kind of prayer life. All we have to do looms before us. Are men's congregations like that too? Well, we can leave the men out of this for the moment, although it applies to them as to anybody. I'd like to speak about that question for a bit. We're dealing with an intelligent sister. You'll notice that she says in that first sentence, now during retreat, prayer comes easily. That tells me two things about her. One is she is a woman of pretty advanced prayer, maybe very advanced prayer, because as she puts it, during retreat, when once she can get quiet, away from the rush of everyday life, the mind pressure problem, God comes in easily to her. Prayer comes easily. She has really grown in prayer. Now, the second thing that this sentence tells me, though she did not have it in mind to make the point, I'm quite sure, there is something wrong with the rest of the year. Because prayer, being primary, in the sense she means it, should come easily all the time. Now, if you buckle and disagree with me on this point, I'm quite sure your premises are different than the ones I mentioned, your presuppositions. Because if prayer is primary, if as a person you're an end of absolute value, that action in the church, work is subordinated to contemplation, etc., then you must hold that in the sense she means it, prayer should be coming easily whether one is in retreat or not. I know it's much more difficult in the ordinary work year to have that quiet. I know that because I have the same problem you do. Different details, but the same problem. So that something has to be adjusted in life. Now, the sentence, or the question rather, goes on, and it illustrates the mind pressure problem. During the school year, we are so rushed, one activity after another, that we cannot pray well. Notice that. She's intelligent. She knows that all through the year, prayer being what it is, what we've been saying in the whole series, what Scripture says, God says, common sense also says, when one reflects on it, that is supposed to pray, come well all through the year. And she's saying that we're so rushed, one activity after another, we cannot pray well or advance in any kind of prayer life. Prayer life is a growth thing. Living things grow. It's a life. And therefore, we should be growing through the year, not only during retreat. The mind pressure problem. The third kind of problem that we can assume under this title of time pressures is workaholism. We spoke about that in a previous segment, and we won't repeat it here. But that obviously is a time pressure problem, usually, though, of one's own free choosing. Doesn't have to be that way. Now we're ready for our main area about time pressures. And I'm going to call it Pointers Toward Solution, a rather modest title. Notice I am not going to give you what you might call a blueprint. I'm not going to tell you in your marriage how you're supposed to line up work and care for the children and jobs and money. And I'm not going to tell you anything of that for a number of good reasons. One is I don't know the details of your life. Number two, you're intelligent. You can figure out your details, the blueprint. And I am not going to try to give you one. What I'm going to do, another reason I'm not going to try, I wouldn't be sure of what I said if I were to. I am very sure of what I'm going to say. And I'm calling these pointers toward solution, namely ideas, realities, pointers that you have to consider in your time pressure situation, I must consider in mine, the Pope must consider it in his, because he's got one too. And he's got to settle it just as you and I do, if he's going to live the gospel fully. And this Pope certainly is living the gospel fully. And it's not my place by any means to tell him what to do, and I'm not. But I am saying what everybody must live, the gospel. Pointers toward solution. The first one is, and it'd be mysterious to you for a minute or two or three, large-mindedness. What does that mean here? A mind reflects reality. If I know, and I know somebody, and I think at this moment of the person I know, I'm reflecting the reality of that person, and because I know, I'm living that person in a deeply mysterious way. Cameras reproduce things, but they don't know things. You've got to live to know and to reproduce a beloved or a tower or a tree or a plant or a flower. By large-mindedness here, I mean a mind that can be embracive of much reality and get enthusiastic about it. And so defined, a large mind that can be interested in many things and be enthusiastic, so defined, there are not many large minds in our world as far as I can make out. How many people, for example, would you know who are interested and enthusiastic both about philosophy and about physics? You might say, I don't know anybody interested in either of them. Well, that could well be. But if you have somebody who is interested in physics, very likely he or she is not interested in philosophy, and the other way around. And both of them are fascinating subjects. It takes a large mind to love them both and be interested in both. How many people could you think of that would be interested in biology and in engineering? Not many, but they're both worthy of interest and enthusiasm, especially biology, but also engineering. How many would you know can get excited about oceanography, study of ocean life, etc., and dance as an art form? Not many, but they're both worthy of amazement, as we said some time ago, wonder. Now, you have a large mind when you have a person who can doesn't have to know everything about everything. None of us can do that. But at least it can be excited about anything, or at least many things. That is a large mind here. You might say, what in the world does that have to do with time pressures? To explain what it has to do, I'm going to borrow a sentence we looked at a few times ago, a few weeks ago. It's from Vatican Council II, the Constitution on the Liturgy, number 2. It is of the essence of the Church that she be both human and divine, visible and yet invisibly endowed, eager to act and yet devoted to contemplation, present in this world and yet not at home in it. Now, let me illustrate a large mind with that last little couplet. Present in this world and yet not at home in it. There are some people who are very present to this world, and that's about all they're present to, is this world. There are other people who may be not very present to this world, but they're also not at home in it. It takes a very large mind to be both present, really with it, involved, interested in this world, in a good sense, and yet to know one is a pilgrim, not at home in it. That takes a very large mind. Saints do that. Paul did it, and the other saints too. But lesser people, it's one or the other. They're not large-minded enough to be both. Now, that brings us precisely to our point. The third couplet says, essential in the church, that we be, quote, eager to act and yet devoted to contemplation. Notice not simply that we act and contemplate, we're eager to act, enthusiastic, and devoted to contemplation. Not simply we do it, we're devoted to it. That takes a very large mind. There are some people who are eager to act, but not at all interested in contemplation. There may be some who are devoted to contemplation, but not eager to act. That isn't too frequent, that second one. But it could happen. You might say, I know a third possibility. There are people who are eager for neither. There are. I've met them, I'm afraid. But it takes a very large mind to be enthusiastic about work to be done and enthusiastic about contemplation, devoted to both of them. Now, that is a pointer towards solution because, a large-mindedness, that is, because if a person does not have a large mind, that person is going to really buy one aspect of the problem, but not the other. At least, we'll buy it with what Newman called a notional assent, but not a real assent. A large mind is one that will buy with a real assent, that will do something about it in reality, will buy both the necessity for work and the necessity for a deep prayer life. And if we don't have that kind of large mind that really is enthusiastic about both of them, we're not going to solve the problem. It can be so difficult. I've heard people tell me about their time pressure problems hundreds of times. I think easily I could say a few thousand times giving retreats. And I've heard all kinds of angles to it. If I don't understand this, I am very dull of mind. So that's the first pointer toward solution. If in your marriage, your convent, your rectory, wherever you are, if you've got these time pressure problems, one or other aspect of it, you're going to solve it only if you buy both aspects of the problem, really buy them. The second pointer towards solution, radicality. By radicality here, I don't mean a kind of wild-eyed barging into something just because it's novel. You kind of like it, and you don't think about it, you don't test about it, you just barge in on it. I don't mean radicality in that sense. I mean it in the etymological sense of the word. It comes from the Latin radix, which means root. And by radicality of solution, I mean that in our life, whether it's marriage, priesthood, convent, you name it, we get to the roots of what we're doing in the human situation and in our vocation. And if we don't get to the roots and solve it from the bottom up, we're not going to solve it. Radicality here does mean a daring to be different. If you're married, you're going to have a deep prayer life only if you are quite different from most married couples. That's just the gospel. In Timothy, we've got it. If you live in devotion to Christ, you're sure to be attacked. Not everybody will like it. People will blame you for it. So radicality does include that. If I'm going to be the priest I ought to be, a lot of people won't like it. C'est la vie, you know. That's part of life. We've got to dare to be different. Not to turn things upside down with no good reason, but getting to the roots of things will require that we challenge conventional wisdom. Now, why am I saying radicality of solution? I'm saying it for much the same reason I spoke of large-mindedness. The time pressure problem is so difficult to solve, and I think you know what I mean when I say that. It is so hard to find the blueprint. What specifically do we do in our marriage, or do I do in the priesthood, or in a religious life? What do I have to do practically to have ample time for prayer? That can be difficult to solve. And if we're not radical in our solution, going from the bottom up, the roots of who we are and what we're about, we're not going to get ourselves to solve it. The second reason that I'm speaking of radicality is the best reason you can have for anything, the Lord Jesus. He faced a time pressure problem, and he solved it radically. Let me share the instance with you. In Mark's Gospel, chapter 6, I'm going to read you verses 30 to 32 without interruption. then I want to talk about them. The apostles rejoined Jesus and told him all they had done and taught. Then he said to them, "You must come away to some lonely place all by yourselves and rest for a while." For there were so many coming and going that the apostles had no time even to eat. Let's stop there. There's one more verse, however. Notice the apostles have been working. That's part of what we're talking about. How do you put together work and prayer in one life? They've been working. And they come back and they're very tired. You can tell that from what the Lord says. Notice further, Jesus said to them, "You must come away to a lonely place." He doesn't say, "You may go away to a lonely place if you want to kind of give in to yourself, or if you want to be selfish. You must go to a lonely place and rest for a while." And you know what the Lord did when he went to lonely places? He prayed, which can be a very restful thing, by the way. In any event, he does not make it optional. Now, then Mark explains why the Lord said this. There were so many coming and going that the apostles had no time even to eat. That's a clear time pressure problem. Clear as day. They're so busy, apparently, with good things that they don't have time even to eat their meal. Now, before we go on, let me give you an example of how we face that kind of situation in modern life. Then we'll take a look at what the Lord did. I'll make up a case. Since I deal so much with sisters, I'll make up a convent case. It's a good one, but you can apply it to marriage. Suppose you've got 10 sisters teaching in a school, and one day one of the sisters comes to the principal, and she says something like this, "You know, sister, this rat race every day is just wrong. We get up at 5:30 in the morning, we get to the chapel by 6, we have our contemplative prayer to 6:30, 7 o'clock, then we have mass, then we rush in, get our breakfast, and then we're into the classroom by, 7:30 maybe, getting it ready for the children who are coming shortly. And we're on our feet all morning, which is an exhausting thing. To be speaking is more exhausting to me, I can tell you this, than digging a ditch. But in any event, so we're on our feet performing all morning. We rush into the faculty room for lunch at 12 o'clock, 15, 20 minutes. We're out in the schoolyard supervising the youngsters during their free time. Then we're back in the classroom on our feet again at 3 o'clock. And even at 3, when the buses come, we're still not free. We've got to see all the children on the buses. We're legally responsible for them. Then we probably have some extracurricular activity to supervise. And we might get back to the convent by 4. Then we're going to have afternoon prayer at 5 o'clock. And we're exhausted. This is wrong." That's what she says. She's not a complainer. She's intelligent, and the principal is intelligent. My example, too. Now, at that point, the principal will probably say something like this. "Well, you know, sister, you're right. This is a rat race. It shouldn't be like this, but this is modern life. We don't have the money to buy or to hire teachers, other teachers, or teachers' aides. We just don't have the money. And we can't do anything else. C'est la vie, you know." And the sister who came in for the chat sees that she's getting sympathy, all right, but there's no solution forthcoming, which is just about what most of us do in modern life. We lament the situation, it's bad news, but we feel we can't do anything about it. Now, let's take a look at the Lord. He does do something about it. Radical. So notice, the apostles are tired, they must go away to rest for a while, and Mark explains, there's so many people coming and going for good things, the apostles can't even eat. Just like the sister in the convent. They can't even have a peaceful noon lunch. Now, here's what the Lord did about it. So, they went off in a boat, the apostles and the Lord. They went off in a boat where they could be alone, all by themselves. Or, as it really is, I modified that a bit. So, they went off in a boat to a lonely place where they could be by themselves. Now that is about as radical as you can do. The Lord just pulled the apostles out of all these people asking for good things, pulled them out, and left. The only more radical thing I can think of is to shoot the people. And that's not permissible. So you don't solve the problem by getting rid of the people. You must, however, make the solitude that is needed. And that's what the Lord did, and it is very radical solution. And because he did it, and he's right, he knows, for example, that the apostles are needed to be deeply prayerful men, else they're not worth much to other people. He knows that. And he also knows that they need to preserve their health, because they're supposed to be apostles for some time, not just a week or two. That brings us to our third pointer towards solution. A rigorous honesty in the use of time. Some people have a remarkable talent for frittering away time. Idleness, not only in speech, but idleness in action. That 15, 20 minutes can go by and nothing really has happened. I'm not saying that we have to be hyper about things and on edge about them, but we should use time reasonably well. And that's part of the solution of the time pressure problem. Not to waste time with a lot of idlenesses of diverse types, whether it's in speech or activity. That brings us to the fourth pointer toward solution, imagination. There are lots of practical ways of handling practical problems. How you run your day, typically, how I run my day. There's a whole hierarchy of things that we do every day. And we can alter them and change them and modify the way we handle things. There might be, and often is, one truth about something. But there might be five ways of pursuing the truth. Whether one is a teacher, or a cook, or an administrator, you can delegate, for example, you can modify how you're going to handle something, you can do something only twice rather than three times in certain circumstances. Again, it is not for me to give you the blueprint of solution, but to have an imagination. There are lots of ways of handling all the practicalities of your typical day. Join us next time for another edition of Prayer Quest. Thank you.